From number one New York Times bestselling author C.J. Box comes the thrilling new novel, Battle Mountain. After a brutal campaign of destruction leaves Game Warden Joe Pickett and Falconer Nate Romanowski in tatters, Nate goes off the grid, preparing for vengeance. Meanwhile, Joe teams up with a rookie to find a missing person in the Sierra Madres, leading both journeys to converge at Battle Mountain. Pick up a copy today. Available now wherever books are sold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. Allison's here, everybody. I meant for it. I meant for the applause.
And you just conveniently don't have the applause.
The applause isn't here anymore. I must have taken it off.
Yeah, maybe. It's like a Freudian slip of the button.
I won't use that. Let me start over.
No, you can. Let's be fair. Let's be honest. Let's not sugarcoat it. Tell me how you really feel.
It was a mistake. Woo!
That's how excited I am to be here.
It was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
I'm glad you're having fun.
How you doing, Allison?
I'm doing well. I feel appreciated and loved. I even did my job and brought a curiosity for the week.
I know. We'll hear that after the interview.
Yeah. It's snazzy.
On tonight's show, I'm going to be talking to Leslie and Stephen Shaw, both of them, two for one, about their book, who they are and what they're up to.
Who are they?
They're quote-unquote aliens, but they don't think they're from another planet. It's a pretty interesting conversation because I'd say they're far more, quote-unquote, nuts and bolts than I am. But they're not nuts and bolts in the way a lot of UFO people are. They don't think they're coming from another planet. They have a pretty interesting take on it. And as the interview goes on, I kind of press them a little bit on that. And I start bringing up the weirder aspects of this. And we get into some of Stephen's encounters, which are very weird, strange, familiar territory kind of stuff. So. You know, while we start out this very sort of nuts and bolts UFO thing, the conversation, I think, progressively gets more strange familiars as we go on.
Yeah, maybe it's just the lens you're looking through.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to them, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thank you so much, patrons. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your help. We could not make Strange Familiars without you. If you like what we do and you'd like to help us make Strange Familiars and get more content besides, you can become a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. All of our patrons get commercial-free versions of the weekly shows, as well as extra content. We do at least one full extra episode of Strange Familiars for our patrons every month. Sometimes we even do more. Once again, that link is patreon.com/strangefamiliars. You can also sign up via Apple Podcasts. There's a program there called Patron of the Strange, and Apple Podcast subscribers get the commercial-free shows weekly, as well as the extra shows monthly. Thanks to all of our patrons, wherever you are, it's a huge help. One more reminder before we get on with the interview, Riverbend Comics will be featuring me on their Whatnot show. May 10th. That's Friday at 7 p.m. And that is going to be my sort of whatnot debut. Probably I'll be doing some live drawing that we'll be auctioning off. We'll be auctioning off books and some of my prints and stuff like that. But it's also a hangout. You can come hang out. It'll be like a live thing, so come hang out with us.
Is this going to be in the Riverbend Comics?
I think we're doing it here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think.
Good
I think,
to know. I guess I'll be clean off the kitchen table.
I think we're doing it here. Yeah, it's come hang out with us, and we'll do live auctions and hang out, and we can talk and whatever else. It'll kind of be like a Strange Familiars live event. But
and
also,
please be patient with us, because John is helping us learn how to do this, and there's a learning curve, and I don't like learning curves.
Well, John's running this one, so this is through Riverbend. So make sure to follow Riverbend Comics on whatnot, but also follow Strange Familiars on whatnot, because we're going to start our whatnot shows after doing this one with John. So the idea is introduce Strange Familiars audience to Riverbend Comics whatnot, and then Riverbend Comics whatnot audience, which is quite large, mm-hmm. to Strange Familiars. Again, that's May 10th at 7 p.m. Like I said, like a live hangout, but with an auction element. Hopefully we'll see everybody there. We'll probably do that for maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. We'll see how it goes, if there's enough people to keep it going. If nobody shows up, we might cut it off before then. So please show up.
Otherwise, it's just going to be three of us eating pizza, probably.
Yeah, just hanging out. Pizza.
Pizza.
All right. Let's go ahead and start this conversation with Leslie and Stephen Shaw about their book, Who They Are and What They're Up To. I'd like to welcome Leslie and Stephen Shaw to Strange Familiars. How are you doing tonight?
So much for having me. Yeah, we're doing well. Well, beautiful day in California, too.
Yes.
It's cold and rainy here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we'll get that over the weekend coming up.
But, yeah, I didn't mean to rub it in.
For the next couple of days, we're okay.
Are you north, south? What part are you in?
Southern California, near Palm Springs. So
east of Los Angeles.
Yeah. Apparently, by Friday, the snow level is going to drop to about 3,000 feet. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a little chillier.
It's coming.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about your book. It's called Who They Are and What They're Up To. Who is the who we're talking about in this title? Obviously, I know because I read it, but for the listeners.
Oh, good. You read it. Thank you.
Yes. The who in this case is who are flying the UFOs in our airspace? That's the question we most wanted to answer. And then secondarily, what they want, you know, what they're after and where they're coming from.
We take a very kind of scientific viewpoint, and I would call it, having been a doctor for 20 years, I look at it from the standpoint of when you hear hoofbeats, look for horses first and not zebras. So, you know, we both found that, like Leslie will tell you later on, that UFO theory and UFO facts were just not meshing up, and that's what we found in 20 plus years of research.
And so we had to pitch those theories and construct new ones that do fit the facts. And then after that, we wrote a book about it.
It's a hard topic to grasp with the amount of information and disinformation and silly information, good and bad information. There's a whole mix of it out there, as I'm sure you know.
Yes, very much so.
Unfortunately, we do.
One of the things I like best about our theory is that it doesn't require any theoretical science to be the case. It doesn't require faster than light travel or wormholes or interdimensional travel or time travel. Our theory fits within currently understood science.
And also pre-understood stuff such as, like, you know, for instance, in the Bible, the fiery chariots coming down to the ground. Even in China, the first emperor Wang Di descending in a fiery dragon. You know, very, very reminiscent of, you know, rocketry.
Good old fashioned rocketry. Yes.
So even in ancient texts, it's not talking about, you know, ridiculous stuff that we're talking about now. So
although now we think they're not using rocketry anymore.
Yeah, we think they've evolved.
They've evolved to using nuclear power of some kind for their ships, because people who get too close to them they sometimes experience electromagnetic radiation burns on their skin. Mm-hmm. So, and because they don't leave a chemtrail of any kind or any exhaust of any kind or any heat signatures really of any kind, we figure that they're not using rocketry now, not anymore.
Yeah, they've evolved.
One of the things I find interesting about, you know, UFOs over time, if you look at them, like if you look at starting in the late 1800s when they were having the airship sightings, and they were seeing these airships before we had airships.
Right.
You know,
before,
yes.
Before we had them. And then they kind of move into this, like, you know, these like Art Deco saucers. And then, in the 70s, they had the black triangles just before we had stealth fighters. They had black triangles.
Yes.
Now people are talking about these jellyfish things. They always seem to be a step or a few steps ahead of us, technologically speaking. I think it's very interesting psychologically, I think that is.
Yes, but not crazy far ahead of us. Like, in our theory, they're about 13,000 years ahead of us, maybe somewhat more.
Yeah, give or take, you know.
Like, yeah.
Give or take, you know.
But, you know, not they're not a million years ahead of us, right? They're still crashing their ships once in a while, and we can understand nuclear power. It's not out of the realm of our understanding.
Yeah, you've always got to, like, watch their actions and not their words. That's another thing I like to say. And, you know, as an example, for instance, we know that Foo Fighters started showing up around, you know, toward the end of the Second World War. And we know that, Admiral Byrd looks like that he did meet with, quote unquote, the masters or a master down in Antarctica in the late February 26th and past that area. And there was a fight that occurred where USOs came out of the ocean and took out at least one destroyer and about half of the planes and killed a number of guys. And, you know, Admiral Byrd was this guy that had, you know, he was like, he was made admiral before any other person in history.
Yes.
And he had everything to lose by just making up lies.
He was an American hero.
You got to look at, you know, that we did the operation of, Paperclip, and we took, you know, we got Von Braun and his team. And so we basically took a lot of the information from Germany, and then within like less than a year and a half, all of a sudden we're manning this operation down into Antarctica for no really good reason, except for at the time was saying that we're just doing, you know, research and just, you know, training for future wars and, you know, for, you know, battling in snow. So you got to look at the motivation.
We think their mandate was to destroy the Nazi base under the ice sheet that they believed was there. Because, you know, Hitler was showing a ridiculous amount of interest in Antarctica from the late 30s on.
That's for sure.
Sending large amounts of men and resources to the continent. And we believe Admiral Byrd was tasked with destroying this base, and that was Operation High Jump. And it was supposed to be a 6-month operation, but it was over in 2 months with them turning tail and running back to South America.
Where we did an interview.
Yes. To back up a little, when we started doing our research, you know, we first looked at the possible premise that these are space aliens coming from distant star systems.
Yes.
But that kept not aligning with what facts we had. It didn't align with the fact that they're seen 10,000 times a year, every year, mm-hmm. and for thousands of years.
And as we found out, it's really more like about 100,000 times a year.
Right, because there's only about 10% reporting, we believe. So really, they're being seen 100,000 times a year. And it didn't make sense, like, why they would care so much about our nukes, that they would follow our military every single time they go out on maneuvers everywhere all around the world at all times. And that just didn't make sense. What are they so worried about? You know, well, then we started going along with the premise that maybe Admiral Byrd's meeting with the Ariane under the ice sheet really did occur. And then suddenly everything started sneaking into place. That explains why they're seen 10,000 times a year. That explains why they've been seen for thousands of years, and explains why they're taking so many Caucasian persons, you know, abducting them. You know, like a space alien from our, you know, another solar system is not going to have a lot of use for human Caucasian DNA, but a race separated from us thousands of years ago, living under the surface of our world, they would have all kinds of uses for for genetic material from Caucasian persons.
And what really kind of like got both of us to the hearings, that the congressional hearings this past summer, were Grush and Graves and the other guy, the whistleblower, and then the two pilots. That
these, Fravor that, is the other.
Fravor, yeah. Yes. They said that, you know, literally, and we didn't know this at the time, that every single time that the aircraft carriers and they're going on maneuvers, whether it be San Diego or off of Virginia or the East Coast, whatever.
All over the world.
All over the world. This includes China and Russia and the UK and Australia, that they are monitoring and they are following us every single time we go out. And there still is this hush thing that is going on with our military. You're basically dissuaded and basically said, no, you know, okay, you see it, but don't really talk about it. But yeah, the thing is that it is happening and it is escalating.
And we think that our government discovered the existence of these people, probably, we think, through Admiral Byrd and his report when he went back to Washington, where he was then muzzled for his entire life, except that he wrote this posthumously discovered diary.
Right.
We think they discovered these beings living under the surface, and we think the reports that Eisenhower met with them are true, and we think that they created a pact where they would share some of their technology with us, and we would keep their secret, and we would not interfere with their abduction program and their bizarre hybrid alien human breeding program. Not that we could have stopped them anyway, but I think we made the agreement to not try and interfere with that. And we think that they set a deadline for disclosure that has come and gone. And we believe that's why they're starting to show themselves more often. Hmm. They're trying to force the disclosure of their existence.
Yeah, it appears that we are the ones, you know, the humans, we are the ones that have basically said, we have more to lose than we have to gain by admitting that we have cousins that are literally living under our feet that are more advanced than we are. So you look at it like from the standpoint of there's 8 billion people on the planet, right? We have multiple different religions, and we saw what happened in 1938 with War of the Worlds. Now, we've become a little bit more desensitized with movies like Star Wars and Star Trek and that kind of stuff. But as far as like stock markets and religions and people's belief systems, we have a heck of a lot to lose. And I think that we are also less evolved than what we call our cousins that are living on the planet cohabitating with us. Really what we have found, frankly.
We think they are coming here from bases around the solar system, too.
Yeah, in addition.
So in that way, yes, they are extraterrestrials sometimes. We think they have bases on Mars and the moon. And
Phobos.
And Phobos. A structure was found on Phobos as well. And so we think they're spread out in our own solar system, but we do not think they're coming here from distant star systems. And when we say cousins, it's because I kept hearing about aliens that were men, humans, you know, a bird describes them as human.
Yeah.
And, you know, Valiant Thor was described as human, a red-haired Caucasian man, you know. And the Nordics, as we all know, are indistinguishable from Scandinavian humans. They're tall, blonde, blue-eyed, green-eyed. And so we think that this is a branch that split off from us. And we think that they utilize genetic modification in creating these other aliens that are people are seeing. The grays, the
reptilians,
the insectoids, etc. We think that they're just, they use genetic manipulation like we would use any tool.
Like Legos. They're mm-hmm. easy. It's very easy. They have more experience, so more time, more experience.
And since you've read our book, I have to correct a mistake we made. At the time that we wrote the book, the Hiawatha asteroid impact crater had just been discovered, and it was only 500 miles from the Labrador Sea, where we surmised the giant tsunamis of the Great Flood began. And then it turned out that that crater was, no, that was 48-million-year-old crater, and it turned out that the on the other side of the Labrador Sea, 500 miles on the other side of the Labrador Sea, is the Younger Dryas Comet impact zone, and that is the correct age.
That hit in Lake Superior.
Yeah, that is the one we were looking for.
It hit 12,850 years ago, and that is that's the murder weapon.
Yeah, so that's a correction we'll be making when we'll create another edition and make.
Yeah, Leslie always says, you know, that I like to say that it was still Colonel Mustard with the knife, but he wasn't in the kitchen this time. Colonel Mustard with a knife. In the living room.
Yeah, or the conservatory.
The same thing still happened. Oh. You know? So we had the dead body, we had the murder weapon. It just was in a different location.
So is that where you're getting the number of 13,000 years more advanced than us?
Yes.
Yeah, 12. Okay. Yeah. It's around the time. Yes.
Because this is something actually I studied more than Stephen. I was a major, an ancient art history major, and studied some of the ancient peoples of the world and the Clovis people and so on. And there were these bizarre extinctions that happened 13,000 years ago. And people were trying to figure out what caused them, what happened. And, you know, they were blaming the Clovis people for wiping out the mammoth.
Except that they also went extinct too, so.
And except they disappeared as well. But then about three decades ago, nanodiamonds were discovered in the soil around the Labrador Sea, especially in 13,000-year-old soil. There's a layer of soil called the Ucello Horizon that's a layer of charcoal that indicates, and this is a widespread layer.
It's about an inch thick.
It's on 10 different countries and 4 different continents.
Yeah.
So it's a very widespread effect. And then the Younger Dryas boundary after that was 1,100 years of climate upheavals that directly after that. But the Ucello Horizon shows that an enormous amount of our forests in the Northern Hemisphere were all on fire at the same time.
Yes.
And there isn't a lot of things that'll cause that. But one of the things that will cause that is air bursts with a comet or an asteroid or meteor coming through our atmosphere.
Yeah, that doesn't happen with volcanoes going off unless you have like about 50 volcanoes going off.
That's a little round. But then the nanodiamonds made it completely proven. Smoking gun. And it was all over except for the shouting once nanodiamonds were discovered. Because nanodiamonds form in no other way. They form when a celestial body comes through our atmosphere bringing dust particles with it. And those dust particles, they superheat and turn into these little tiny microscopic round diamonds. And the area around the Labrador Sea has a highest concentration of them, which is why we were looking in that region for a comet or an asteroid impact. And who knew there were two of them within 500 miles of the Labrador Sea.
One was about 58 million years ago. The other one was 12,850.
I think it's 48.
Yeah. So yeah, we got let down. We were just going off of what was the most reliable information
at the time. Yeah, but since then, the Younger Dryas has been discovered. So
anyways, it still happened.
Yeah, but the flood myths that led us to this conclusion a long time ago. I read Fraser's book. Have you ever read that one, Timothy?
I don't think so.
No. It was written in the 1700s by this guy named Fraser, and he went around the world looking for ancient flood myths. And he found about 500 of them and published them in his book. And since that time, more have been discovered. So now there's something like 1,200 of them.
Hancock has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, Hancock and David Childress and a few other famous names in our field. It's remarkable how similar each flood myth is to the other. they all had pre-warning of some kind. They almost all of them say the same thing. Like, God warned us that he was going to destroy the world. And if we wanted to survive, we had to build an ark, or we had to go to very high ground. Some people were told to go to high ground if they lived near the mountain ranges. Or some people were told to dig under the ground.
Like Derinkuyu in Turkey.
Yes, that we believe that was... There's an old story about the god Ahura Mazda in Zoroastrian mythologies, that he supposedly came to King Yima and told him that there would be a winter like they'd never experienced before, hundreds of years long. And in order to survive it, they had to dig underground. And the idea that they could dig this underground city quickly, it doesn't make sense. It's more like they probably had a year and change of time.
They had more than a year. It's 13 levels deep, and we don't even know really how deep it is, quite frankly. The first two levels were for livestock, and they even had like churches that they had down there. Mm-hmm. They had places to make wine. They had all kinds of air vents.
It definitely looked like it was meant for long occupation.
It was definitely. They had forewarning for sure.
And we think, you know, the Göbekli Tepes and the other tepes that are being discovered in the region that are roughly, 12,000 years old, 11,000 years old?
Yeah, they're 12,000.
We think that this culture may be from this group that survived the cataclysm. And then when they emerged from their underground cities, they moved south, which is only, the Anatolia Plateau where Derinkuyu is about 4,700 foot elevation.
And it's about a couple hundred miles in front.
Yeah, it's like 300 miles from the coastline.
The coast, yes.
The tepes are all also about 300 miles away. So we think that they came out of their underground city on the top of the plateau and then moved to more lower elevation to recreate their civilization.
It's all fascinating what we found with our research. It really is. It was some stuff we weren't even, honestly, Timothy, we weren't even expecting to find, but it's just like, you know, when you hear hoofbeats, so you look for horses first and not zebras, you know?
So how do you think these more advanced peoples were able to survive then?
Oh, that's pretty simple.
We think it's kind of like a Deep Impact scenario, that movie, you know? Because they were confronted with the same problem as in the film, right? They saw a extinction level event asteroid coming to destroy them
in a year or two.
And they had a little bit of time. And of course, they sent a bunch of heroes to blow up the asteroid. But plan B was to sink these underground arcs. And these underground arcs were going to be sunk in different continents, on different countries were going to have their own. And we would then take the cream of our crop, the, you know, best humans we had. And then, you know, dig in underneath and bring their knowledge and their technology with them. So then after the comet struck and caused this 1,100 years of climate upheaval, that killed a lot of people after the main impact, which caused tsunamis all over the world.
Yeah, this is another thing we found out, too. Myself, having been a doctor in Chinese medicine for 20 years, that one thing I really enjoy is researching stuff. And what we found out was that there was a genetic bottleneck, that occurred about 13,000 years ago, where the people on the Earth, Homo sapiens, were reduced to about a population base of around about 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. So the 8 billion people that are on the Earth right now have regenerated from a base of only 10,000, which makes us really kind of not that genetically diverse when you really think about it, you know, for 10,000 to make 8 billion. So,
and in point of fact, we are not very, diverse as we should be.
We're not, you know, probably things such as telepathy and other things that we had in the past were probably fairly common.
So we think that we were at least some of the population of Earth were fairly advanced at the time.
Yes.
And they had astronomy, advanced astronomy, to be able to spot this thing coming.
Yeah, we know that.
And give warning to the peoples of the world. But then the thing strikes, and our population is divided into two. People who escaped the cataclysm with their knowledge, their culture, and their technology intact, and the rest of us poor schmoes on the surface of the world that were almost wiped out to a man. And after the cataclysm and the waters receded, they still had 1,100 years of climate upheaval to deal with. It threw us back into a stone. We were coming out of an ice age when the thing struck.
Yeah.
But the Younger Dryas boundary proves that at that moment when it struck, we reversed course and plunged right back into the ice age again. So the people left on the surface, maybe they could have retained their technology and their knowledge, except for the fact that they were faced with this very difficult world to survive in. They couldn't grow crops. They would have had to gone back to hunter-gatherer lifestyles. And our technology just didn't survive it. So we were back in the Stone Age.
And what's happening right now, you'll see on different programs where these mega billionaires, they're doing the same thing we're talking about right now. They are either trying to get off planet, or they're making these underground fortresses that have everything from moats and God knows what, just crazy stuff. And just like you're planning for an apocalypse, you're just like, hey, I got an extra couple billion dollars. Might as well make myself 40,000 square foot, palace, 100 feet underneath the earth. You know, it's like we're doing the same stuff right now. It's like, people have to really wake up and understand what's going on, in my opinion.
And then after the flood, a lot of these flood myths refer to a god that comes and teaches them civilization again.
Yes.
A lot of them. And this is, Viracocha comes to mind, Kukulcan.
Huang Di.
Yeah, some others where the Egyptian pantheon as well. Supposedly, we had devolved into barbarism and cannibalism. And I think that the people that went underground took pity on us. They came back out. They set up pantheons of pretending to be gods, because it's easy to control people if they think you're a god. And they taught us, a lot of these flood myths say the same thing. They taught us how to grow crops again and how to...
Animal husbandry.
Yeah, animal husbandry, and how to build buildings and do math and all kinds of civilization that we had lost. I think they took pity on us and came back to the surface in these pantheons of
always 12
fake gods. Yes. I mean, and a lot of times we refer to them as gods, but they're strangely mortal gods, right? And had extended lifespans longer than ours. And we hear about it, in the Bible and stuff, how they used to live 1,000 years instead of our measly 120. Yeah.
There's Enoch, then there was Methuselah, then there was Lamech, and then there was Noah. They all lived almost 1,000 years.
And we think this might be examples of the Adamic race, who are longer lived than we are, and possibly are, according to what we've read, the way they extend their lives is through manna or some sort of concoction that they consume.
Ambrosia, manna, whatever. Yes.
And we think that not only are they 13,000 years more advanced than we are, we also think they might be more spiritually advanced than we are. For instance, we think that telepathy is a human characteristic that has atrophied in us, but has not atrophied in them. And that's why they're able to communicate with us telepathically. The other thing that I found proof that they're human is that they're breeding with us.
Right.
These bizarre breeding programs. I mean, we've heard about it, of course, through Enoch and the Watchers and the Book of Enoch talking about how they would breed. They took wives, human wives, and had children.
The Nephilim.
If they truly are a different species than us, they would have to interbreed with us using genetic modifications of some kind and in vitro fertilization of some kind. But we're actually hearing reports that they're just plain having sex. They're having sex with human females that they take, and then they impregnate them, and then they steal the fetuses at 4 or 5 months. And we think this is another indicator that we're talking about humans here.
Right.
Why do they choose to remain hidden at whatever point they come out again, when they determine it's safe to come out? Why not just rule the world? Why not just come out and say, we're taking over?
Well, you see, that's a really, really good point, and we've kind of entertained what our viewpoint is on this. You know, I think part of it is like what happened in 1938, the worlds with Orson Welles, and you know, as far as you know, human beings are pretty xenophobic, and we want to feel like now we're like the top dog on the planet. As far as like saying, hey, we've been here for 13,000 years, and we actually are your cousins, and we've been taking people and impregnating women and making hybrids and also taking your cattle and exsanguinating them, I think that it would be, you know, it would have bad effects upon, you know, the Earth's religions, on stock markets. I think it's actually kind of what we think is actually kind of us that have decided that, no, we want to kind of keep this still kind of secret. We right. still want to get your technology, and you could take some cows, you could take some people. But, you know, we want to, like, last summer they said that, okay, yeah, we agree that the UFOs are here. We don't know what they are. And then about a month and a half ago, they came out from the Pentagon saying they did a study from Arrow.
They're not extraterrestrial.
The ones that are, you know, took over from ATIP. And they're saying, oh, we have no credible evidence that there's UFOs at all.
Right.
They're going right back to where they were.
Yeah. This brief little flurry of hope for more transparency and more disclosure.
So it's but, really us.
But no, they're going, and they're still punishing whistleblowers. And you know, we know that these three videos that Elizondo leaked, you know, to the New York Times.
In 2017.
These, if they're following our military every single time we go out on every single maneuver, we know there's, you know, miles of this kind of video or recordings, rather.
The tip of the iceberg, really.
So, of course, but they're still not sharing, and they're still punishing whistleblowers and going after Grush, you know. So they really haven't changed their policy. But I am noticing a policy change with the UFOs. For many years, it seemed that they were spotted in the U.S. an average of 3,200 times per year. But in 2019, that number drastically jumped. It doubled, in fact, to about over 6,000. I think they are kind of making efforts towards disclosure. Not our government. They're as tight as ever. But I think the aliens, for lack of a better word, we actually call them intraterrestrials rather than extraterrestrials, yeah. A word we coined in our book. But we think that the Phoenix Lights incident is a good example. The UFO began in Nevada. It flew over the entire state of Arizona slowly and made sure to go right over Phoenix, the biggest population center.
And then ended up in Mexico.
And then actually entered, crossed the border into Mexico. So it's like they were showing themselves to us very, very purposefully. And I think crop circles might be further clues that they're trying to disclose to us. It's almost like they're trying to enter our consciousness gradually for some big reveal. That's our hope, of course, and that someday, we'll know for sure if we're right or not.
That's what we see, at least.
Yes.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do you or do your theories in any way account for the very, very odd high strangeness that tends to accompany UFO sightings and UFO experiencers?
I'm sorry, what kind of strangeness?
High strangeness.
High strangeness, the really, really weird stuff. People seeing a UFO, going home, seeing a 6-foot bunny that's colored plaid in their lawn. It just disappears. Oh, yes. I've got some examples from my personal experiences. Yes. I see them here.
When they take people, they mess with their memories. And the thing they most often mess with is what the aliens look like. The actual physical being that took you is changed, and it changes into bizarre things. Stephen saw them as garden gnomes one time.
When I was about 8 years old.
And his brother did too. And his mother saw them as Chinese people, little Chinese people.
About 5 foot tall.
And I hear all kinds of things, like you said, you know, or it's a rabbit and it's plaid, like, you know, like you say, it's something completely bizarre. But I think what it is signs of memory tampering. And the key word I like to listen for when I hear these descriptions is that the memories seem to have a shimmery quality to them. And I believe this is a sign of memory tampering.
Well, yeah, as an example, what you said you read our book. Did you read like the foreword and all that stuff?
I did. I've been reading it over the you know, the next couple months.
So you know about the coins that were magnetized in my pocket?
Yeah.
You may remember that. Yes. That was something that my dad and I both experienced together. And just to let your audience know that this was like the third or fourth thing that happened in a week's period of time that the five people experienced. But anyway, I had gotten so freaked out about, you know, sleeping in my bedroom that I decided to sleep in my clothes in the living room on the couch. I was a cabinet maker with my dad, and I had, you know, tools and stuff in my pocket. So anyway, I woke about 5:30 in the morning. This is January of 1979. I was 18 years old, and I looked at my piano, think about what I was going to play that day because I'm a lifelong musician, and listened to the fountain in the other room. And I was certainly awake and alert. And from behind me, about 25 feet behind me, was the front door. And this entity, about 6 to 7 feet tall, floated, walked towards me in about a second and a half to 2 seconds, filling the whole room with this intense blue-white light. And it stopped by my right side. Now, just to go back here a little bit, I grew up in a family that we had this spirit guide called Oglegli that had been following around the family for about 3 generations that several people had seen during different times of need. And I always think to myself, oh, wow, I'm going to see Oglegli that I'd heard about since being like 3 years of age. Anyways, this entity stooped down to my right side, and immediately the right side of my body became paralyzed. Not in a scary way, but just in, I could not move the right side of my body. And then it whispered in my ear, and I couldn't tell whether it was male or female, but it whispered externally, not in my head. And part of me was saying, wow, I'm going to get to see what Oglegli looks like. And the other half of me was saying, dude, you can't move. You are immobilized. So I'm 50-50, like excited and scared, right? And I stayed in that state for like 5 or 10 seconds, and then the entity reversed. It went back out, taking the blue white light with it, went outside the front door. And to this day, at first I thought that I told my dad, but I don't have any memory about telling my dad what happened.
We wrote it in the book because he told me that he went to tell his father, Yeah. But then later, when we tried to regress him into that memory further, maybe he realizes that he never really remembers telling him.
What I do know is what my dad and I saw at 11:30 that morning. I was going to go get some food for lunch, and I pulled the coins out of my right-hand side pocket, and all the standard American coins, they were all magnetized. My dad and I, we could pick up the coins with the coins, the nails with the coins. It didn't matter. Everything was magnetized 6 hours later. And we just looked at each other, just like shaking our heads and, what the heck just happened? This is 6 hours after it happened.
And they're not, it's not supposed to be possible to. They specifically designed them so they don't become magnetized, so they can go in vending machines.
This is, this is like fourth kind. No.
Right, right.
It was like a, you know, what do you call it? You know.
Well, when you're taken, you're abducted.
Basically, you know, I had physical evidence that happened to me. I was touched. I was changed. And so, yeah, this is like just one of like five things that happened over a week's period of time.
So this is what another again. Now, are there electric 7 foot tall, electric white, blue, white beings? Well, we don't I don't think so. But I think that his memory of it is such that it he remembers them that way.
My brother in 1982.
And the family frequently describes the spirit guide, the family spirit guide, as a black man wearing a fez.
A tall black man wearing a red fez.
So people remember these creatures in all different ways. But what we did notice was that right after they encounter them, they almost always have this big black memory block right afterwards. And that's when we started realizing that we're probably dealing with something like this. And then Philip actually did see gray alien in his room. It was one of the taller ones. Yes, he said it was about 6 foot tall.
1982.
And he saw it in his room and then immediately blacked out as well.
This was at a different house, by the way, 350 miles away.
But this was the one of the few times that we think they were seen in their real form. And he was, for once, able to remember what they looked like.
So I'm extremely interested in this spirit guide. You said it had appeared to your family for multiple generations.
Yes.
Three generations. Yes. I'd heard about it from my grandparents and apparently my great grandparents who came from Germany, the Neumanns. They were also aware of this spirit guide called Oglegli. And actually in Tunisian, my uncle, before he died, said that once he and his wife were in, I forget, they're in the Middle East somewhere, and they found out that the word Oglegli means my friend, which is really interesting in and of itself. And my uncle, actually, his life was saved by this Oglegli character.
Yes, it seems to protect the family members sometimes. Yeah. Stephen himself has been saved.
He's not a Newman, a Shaw, or a Roe, which is my family bloodline. He's a Griffiths.
He married into the
Roe family. He married my mother's older sister, and he was a pilot in the RAF in the British Air Force, and just after World War II, and he was stationed for a while in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, which has a really interesting capital name. But anyway, so he was awakened in the middle of the night by this tall entity that he immediately just intuitively knew that this was Oglegli, because he'd heard about Oglegli. And this entity said, Douglas, you need to get out of your cot right now because you're going to be raided and you're going to be killed. You know, so he just didn't like say no. And he just got up.
And it vanished right in front of him.
the entity vanished, and he got out of the 40-man tent. And sure enough, like in a minute or two, a group of rebel raiders came in with machetes and with guns and killed several of his fellow pilots. Wow. And he told me this on several different occasions. This was a guy who, my Uncle Doug, was a no-nonsense guy that was not into flights of fancy. He was just like one of these guys that he became very wealthy. And like I say, it's like one of these things I learned as a young man. But you see, I had heard these stories in different variations growing up as a kid. So again, like just really quickly here, I'm going to say that, you know, when you grow up in elementary school, this is stuff you don't share with your friends. Mm-hmm. They think either you're growing up in a haunted house, they think you're lying,
or
they
weird.
Think you're just basically completely weird.
Yes.
So this is stuff we just kept amongst ourselves. But I grew up with this, and mm-hmm. I just accepted it as being a norm.
When we started researching the abduction phenomenon, the theories at the time, this is a long time ago, the theories at the time were that the aliens are just curious about us. They want to take samples. It's no big deal. They're going to take you and take some samples and put you back and no harm done. And they're going to take a cross-section of humanity because, you know, they're just curious about us, scientific curiosity. But then we discovered that that is not what was going on. What was happening instead was that whenever they would find a bloodline or a genetic line that they liked, that met their criteria somehow, they would start taking that person again and again and again and again through their lives. And then they would start taking their children and their grandchildren. So it tends to follow families for multiple generations. And that's when we realized that that's probably what was going on with Stephen's family, that this old Glegley is both preying on the family, but also protecting the family. And I started realizing they're not taking samples so much as they're harvesting a product. They want our genetic material. They're taking eggs from women and sperm from men, and they take them and then they wait long enough for us to regenerate more of it, and then they take us again. And it's almost like I made the analogy in the book of a cow. You know,
prize cow with a farmer.
Yeah, like a farmer, he has this prize cow in the field, and he pulls it into the barn, he abducts it into the barn every day and removes the milk out of it and then puts it back in the field to go make more milk that he can then harvest again later. And it seemed like it was like that. And also the farmer protects his cow. He offers protection to the cow. So he's both using and preying upon it and at the same time protecting it as being a benefactor towards
the family.
What we
also found out too is that the mythos of the vampires and the succubus
we think
incubus,
so.
If you really think about it, there are so many commonalities between the alien abductions and vampires. What do vampires do? They come in the night. They're very powerful. They hypnotize you. They paralyze you. They take your genetic material frequently again and again, and they can change form or change your memories. Sounds very, very familiar, right? And of course, the incubus and the succubus, you know, they're having...
That's more the sexual
component. They're more the sexual components.
And where they're stolen fetuses, because there's stories about women being raped by an incubus in this case and becoming pregnant, and then the pregnancy turns out to be a false pregnancy. Mm-hmm. They give birth to nothing but air. And to us, that sounds just like this breeding program that they have going with us, where they take a woman, impregnate her, usually by having sex. Then four or five months later, they take her again and steal the fetus. And this has been sort of documented by doctors who have done ultrasounds saying you were pregnant and now it looks like you've never been pregnant. Because when they remove the fetus, they remove everything as far as the placenta, the entire placenta goes with it as well. Whereas in miscarriages, generally the doctor has to then clean the tissue out of the womb afterwards.
Yes.
But in this case, they say it's completely unlike a regular miscarriage.
Well, in my experience with these things, mm-hmm. and I have an idea what you're going to say to this, but I'm just curious to hear it. The Greys have been visiting me. I don't like them. We have a very contentious relationship. And mm-hmm. I happen to be Catholic, and I can end it immediately by saying the Hail Mary. It will stop immediately. They will stop. It's done. The whole experience is done. However, and I always say this when I mention that, other people have reported this as well, but it doesn't matter their religion. Wiccans can say, you know, Wiccan enchantments or whatever. Jewish people have success with Jewish prayers, Muslims with Muslim prayers, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not trying to promote my religion. I'm just saying there is an element of something going on there where they back off and they stop when people people start this.
Stephen, next time they're bothering you, try that.
Well, I have noticed when I for many, many decades, actually, I have resisted, for the most part. For instance, it's hard to say, really. I mean, I've been a Buddhist. I've been a Taoist. I've been mostly in the Eastern religions. I was raised basically a-religious because my parents came over here from England, and they had some pretty bad experiences with the Methodist Church. So anyways, I was raised kind of a-religious. But about a few months ago, I decided to confront this being that showed up in our bedroom. I was in the bed, and it was about 3 or 4 months ago, and it was this tall, heavy-set, about 6.5-7 foot tall being with the golden eyes, and it was just looking at me. And I didn't necessarily feel like it was menacing, but I couldn't get a read on it. But I decided, you know what, I'm just going to say, what do you want from me? I just decided I was going to ask it. And I've heard other people say, well, you can never ask it. You have to tell it, leave you alone, leave me alone. I've seen different entities. When I was 23, I saw this little 2.5 foot tall entity, which we have in the book, that was floating up by the beam in the Fallbrook house where I grew up. I was sleeping on the floor at that time in my life. I was still in the military, and I liked really sleeping on the floor. So I awoke. It was you know, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and there was a little bit of light on in the room, and so I just kind of happened to look up to the beam, one of the beams in the house, and I saw this little being with this triangular shaped head with these big eyes and these big feet, and it just was shimmery again, like Leslie was saying. Mm-hmm. And it floated right down to my right side again, and it said to me in this baritone voice exactly what it said. It says, "Do you want me to help you get out of your body?" Those are the exact words. And something in me intuitively knew I could not show fear. I felt this little tingling below my belly button. So I said to it, "You can help me, but you cannot possess me." And it grabbed my right arm and started moving back up into the air and trying to pull me out of my body. And it's kind of made this kind of a growl sound. And then it just disappeared.
Wow.
And my dad said, "You know, who were you talking to at 5 o'clock in the morning?" He could hear me talking. He heard two voices.
He heard the baritone voice.
So anyways, you know, my mom, back in 82, 83, during the day at the other house that we're building ourselves, because we're builders in Sonora, California, during the day, she was attacked by what she called a black imp that jumped on her back and was like, you know, attacking her neck. And she said, "Get away from me, just get off." And what happened was that the weird thing is that my sister and brother were going to school up there, and everybody in the family, the three of them were up there, they were all experiencing sickness. They were not well. And what ended up happening was, after my mom was attacked by this being, she developed what is called a scrofula on her neck, which is like a goiter. But it's not a thyroid related, but it's basically like you have a
subcutaneous infection.
A subcutaneous infection that she got from being attacked. And she never got over that. And she had that for the rest of her life.
The doctor thought it was probably due to cat scratch fever.
Yeah, the doctor was saying, "Oh, you're probably scratched by a cat." But
no, she wasn't scratched by a black entity.
Yeah, it was a black entity
that attacked her.
My mom was an automatic writer. There's stuff in the book that tells you that, you know, my mom knew things before other people knew. I mean, like, commonly.
Interesting.
And she got that ability from her mother. And then the grandmother, that, you know, they could go. And now my sister is doing automatic riding in Northern England, because they do these tours called ghostly encounters. Ghostly locations. That's it. Sorry.
They do ghost hunting in Northern England.
I tried automatic riding when I was a young man, and I just didn't like it.
The whole family were a very psychic bunch.
Interesting.
And I think that's maybe one of their criteria for choosing the families they prey on.
Yeah.
Did you find that to be so, Timothy? Do you have a psychic people in your family?
I'm not sure. We never talked about this stuff. It would have been not talked about at all. But it's very, very interesting when you said
he was almost trying to pull you out of body. One of my theories with some of these abductions is that they are out of body experiences, and that they are somehow able to pull us out of body and do something. Why or what they're doing at that point, I don't know why. But I'll tell you, this is kind of similar to your mom's thing. I had this, you know, it seemed like it was a dream. I was driving in a car and I looked up at the sky and it was something in the sky. It looked like smoke or something. And then I realized they were numbers in the sky. And I turned to my wife in the car and I said, we're in a simulation. And right as I said that, all of those bright numbers in the sky congealed in light above me. And I began to be pulled upward through the windshield by my feet. So I'm upside down being pulled upward. I say the Hail Mary. I wake up saying the Hail Mary in bed, like saying out loud. So I cut it off. However, two things happened within a very short period. I was getting out of the shower after that at some point, say a week or two after this. And my wife says, oh my God, what's that on your shoulder? And she's like, I'm like, what? And I look in the mirror and my shoulder bone is sticking up. My collarbone is sticking up about an inch just under my skin, but it's sticking up. Well, she says, that's not right. You need to go to the doctor. So yeah. I went to the doctor and they said, well, when were you in a car accident? And I said, I've never been in a car. And they said, well, do you work construction? Something dropped in your shoulder? I said, no. And they said, we do not see this without some kind of injury. Like we don't see this condition without some kind of physical injury. No memory of a physical injury. And then shortly after that, on my legs appeared this condition. I don't know what it was. I went to the doctor. It was a kind of itchy spots, some kind of infection. They ended up giving me antibiotics for it. They never gave me a name for what it was. You know, it kind of cleared up, but a friend of mine said, hey, weren't you pulled by your legs upside down? And I'm like, oh, wow. Goodness. I didn't even think about that. So yeah, it's kind of weird stuff that goes along with this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And people will just think, you know, the average person that hasn't experienced things like that, they'll just think that you're just, you know, you're just forgetting something or misremembering or you're lying.
Yeah,
or
it's wacky stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you're just making stuff up, you know?
And I agree with you as to the astral aspect of this. Stephen, when he was a Tai Chi teacher for many years. And as you know, that Tai Chi is kind of a moving meditation.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it opens the chakras and he was opening them from very young age and able to astral project because of it. And then later, when we got together, we started doing the kind of work, kundalini raising work, where you vibrate your chakras through chanting and meditation and whatnot. And I began astral projecting right away. And Stephen, of course, was doing so as well. For me, astral projection was fun. You know, I got to travel around the world and without buying a plane ticket and scuba diving without having to worry about it being eaten by sharks or drowning. And, you know, I was having a good time.
I went to Egypt a couple times.
Yeah, but poor Stephen, whenever he would go astral, it's like they were waiting for him on the other side of the veil.
I've heard that. So many people like start encountering entities, you know, when they do this. Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Entities bothering him.
Yeah, most of the time, you know, a few times, like one time I went astral, I was just decided to go over Los Angeles at night, and that was really kind of cool. And I was in control. But a lot of times it has been, you know, unfortunately has been not very pleasant for me. Everything from entities trying to attack me. Like this one time I remember, especially Leslie and I, see, I taught her all the three sets of Tai Chi, the 108. And so she was already like doing some of that kind of stuff. And then we started studying with some teachers that were, you know, Kundalini and Buddhists and that kind of stuff. So anyway, so this one morning, it was like a weekend morning or something. She got up and she said, I'm going to go bring in some coffee and some pastries, right? So I'm in bed, okay, it's daytime, so there's light in the room, and then she came in, or what I thought was her, with the pastries and the coffee, and she turned in to this huge serpent with teeth, and she attacks me. She is literally trying to kill me, and so I'm fighting this entity off, and then the real Leslie comes in with the exact same thing, And so she sees me. She sees me struggling, and she's wondering what the heck is going on.
And then he looks at me with.
And his, I look at her, like, kind of fear. And but it's that this time it's the real Leslie.
Yeah.
Wow. You know? Wow.
So this is one of several. Well, I've had a lot of different things, like being like, you know, going to sleep, Timothy. I haven't had that recently, luckily, but I used to for many, many times. I'd be just getting ready to go to sleep, and I hear three distinct knocks behind my head on the wall. This basically always three, and then sometimes it would be a door slamming shut, you know, just as I'm starting to get to sleep. And then sometimes it would be plate glass mirror being broken. Sometimes it would be musical instruments, or it would be frequently I've heard Leslie saying, "Steve," it's just her voice, right? It's her voice. She's in the other room, but she's not saying anything.
No. Nope.
So it's just like, you know, I just have to kind of, I started doing chanting now before and doing the Nam-myo Renge-kyo, that kind of stuff. And doing the and things like that before you go to sleep now to kind of like, you know, protect myself with white light and all sorts of, you know, that kind of stuff. Because
do you find it helps?
Yeah. In fact, it enhances my dream work. I'm a very, as Leslie can tell you, I'm a very, very, very vivid dreamer. I mean, it's like,
yes, I'm so jealous.
my dreams are like most people would be jealous of.
But I agree with you, Timothy. A lot of Stephen's experiences are things that happen to him when he's either trying to go to sleep or having just awakened, which is, you know,
hypnagogic, hypnopompic.
Yeah, the hypnagogic and the hypnopompic states in, you know, the teachers taught us that these are they're kind of like a zone between fully being awake and fully being asleep. And in this state, this is where you can actually separate from your body easily. And so people are afraid of the thing because they feel paralyzed. They can't move. They can think and they can see and look around the room, but they can't physically move yet because they're not awake enough. You know, they're in that halfway state. And it's actually a time of power because you can actually, this is when you can separate from your body should you wish to.
Yeah, it's totally different from sleep paralysis. Sleep paralysis is is really quite different than the hypnagogic or hypnopompic. So,
you know, but it does come with paralysis with it.
Well, you know, the real thing is to have the brainwaves slow down to about 2 to 5 cycles per second, and you're alert. It's like you're alert, and the brainwaves are down to 2 to 5 cycles per second, and you're fully awake. And it feels like sometimes your body's glued to the bed. That's usually what my experience could be. Sometimes it feels like it's, you know, but I'm alert. Doesn't matter if it's during the daytime or during nighttime. And sleep paralysis is really, you know, some people, they confuse it with sleep paralysis, which is something where you will experience some pretty nasty stuff from what I've heard.
When Stephen had that blue-white entity whisper to him and magnetize his coins.
Yes, that's not sleep paralysis.
The very next night, his father awakened. And the way the house was is that his bedroom door was open and he could see all the way down the hallway to Stephen's bedroom door. And, well, you go ahead and explain what you saw.
Yeah, this is something I have no memory of at all. My dad was awakened again in the middle of the night and he saw this wall of blue-white light, intense blue-white light that was right outside of my door.
Flooding
outside of my bedroom door. And he was like getting really frustrated. He said, "I got to see what is going on here," right? So he was getting out of bed, and then a voice inside of his head said, "Jeffrey, just go back to sleep. Nothing to see here. Everything's fine. Just relax." And he went back to sleep.
Okay, yeah. So that's something that's happened to me, and it's something I hear over and over again to people with all kinds of paranormal encounters. They just go right back to sleep. That should not happen.
Right, you're scared.
Yes.
Your head's pounding.
Oh, yes. And you know, the thing is, I have no memory of that. This was happening in my room, but I have absolutely no memory.
But he has all kinds. The family has dozens and dozens of these experiences, and we've put a lot of them on our Instagram page, by the way, at leslie.shaw.author.
Yeah.
Where I did these series called Stephen's Family's Abduction Experiences, you know, and very other weird things, you know.
Right.
But So a lot of these experiences, they are frightened. Like one time, Steve's 10 years old. He's walking down the hallway. Right. He's terrified. His heart is pounding. He's breathing hard. He's scared because he hears something in the living room that doesn't sound right, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just as he's about to turn the corner, he blacks out. And obviously, he didn't just drift back off to sleep here, right? His heart is pounding.
First of all, I crawled out of the top of a bunk bed. Okay.
Yeah. So you have to be awake for that.
I was in my pajamas. I was going down the hallway. I knew it wasn't the dog. And I was definitely in adrenal mode. And my heart was pounding. And I was, you know, adrenal, basically. Mm-hmm. So you don't just go back to sleep, you know, just from being in that type of a state.
Right.
And then next thing I know, a few hours later, I'm back in my bed, the bunk bed on the top, and I'm nicely tucked in, and I just don't know. I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
I just blacked out.
And his brother, Philip, was...
He slept in the closet for two years.
Yeah, he was afraid of the little men that come in the night when he was a child.
Yeah, from about the age of 6 to 8 or somewhere in that area. Yeah. I said, Philip, you know, anyway.
But I was going to talk about the, when he was 16 years old, that's when he saw the gray alien in his room. But the night before he saw it, he was laying in bed and he heard a scrabbling sound. And he thought it was a cat because they had cats. And he reached down
to pet the cat.
And instead of a cat, it's a hand grabs his arm. And he feels this intense rush of adrenaline and terror, and then immediately falls back asleep, blacks out.
The first time I ever remember encountering the graves, and you talk about them messing with your memory, for a long time I thought they were little doctors that were standing next to my bed. This was in the late 1980s or maybe the very early 1990s, and I remember Communion had just come out, and I would see the cover of that book, and I hated it. I never wanted anything to do with it, but I didn't know why. But these were little doctors that were standing next to my bed. Until much later, I saw a TV program that it either had drawings or reenactments of stuff. And I was like, oh, no. And it's sort of like the veil fell away. And then I can't see them as anything but grays now. But at that time, you know, in any case, I was so enraged at what they were doing, and I still don't know what they were doing, that there's no way I should have been. And I kept falling asleep. And I'd wake up and they're still there, and I'm angry and out again. And I wake up and I'm, you know, now I'm even more angry and I'm, you know, boop, out again until, you know, finally in the morning, I throw a punch in that direction, scream at the top of my lungs. I lived in a basement at this time. There was a whole family that lived in the house above me. This isn't like a big mansion. This is like a modern house with, you know, this drywall between us, basically.
Right.
Not a single person, 5 people living upstairs, not a single person heard me scream. Because I went up very sheepishly in the morning to apologize. I was sure I woke the whole house up. Nobody heard me scream. But yeah, there's no way I should have been able to fall. I was so mad. I was so angry. And boop, just kept out again and awake and out again and out again. It's just...
The hormone for anger is what? Cortisol, isn't it? Or
it's one of them, yeah. Cortisol and...
There's no way with a lot of cortisol in you that you can fall asleep.
Yeah,
you
know? It's just silly. I mean, Yeah. Again, I just, you know, in doing this, I talk to so many witnesses of paranormal events, and sometimes it's Bigfoot. Sometimes they'll see Bigfoot, and they're like, I saw Bigfoot looking in my window, and they just rolled over and went to sleep. That makes no sense.
Right.
It's like, there's no sense to that. I used to be scared. So, yeah, there's something about the stuff that I don't know.
And they can dampen consciousness. We know that because from Communion, the Strieber. Oh, when I first read Communion, it's like Strieber's talking about, he's being taken out of bed right next to his sleeping wife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And she's not sleeping through an alien abduction, right? She's being kept asleep through an alien abduction.
Right. Or else, yeah. I mean, the other thing I think of is sometimes they think, like, yes, we can get to you while you're awake, but it's easier to get to you while you're asleep. So, boop, you're out. You're out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it seems like they want... They don't just want your sperm and your eggs. They also want us to do things. They're trying to influence us, I believe. I have a friend, her name is Jean, and I just started putting her series on Instagram. She's an abductee, and she's 73 years old.
Oh.
And I had this theory that they probably stop taking you after you stop having eggs. And, you know, I mean, you know, after a while, you don't have the genetic materials.
The sexual component is not
anymore. Yeah.
Primary anymore.
But she is still constantly contacted and told, you know, to take better care of the planet. And, you know, they're very worried about how we're treating the planet. I keep hearing that again and again, how people are being influenced to try and take better care of the planet, take better care of the planet.
The Zimbabwe children back in the
80s. Yeah, that's another example.
Oh, I mean, it goes back to the contactees in the 60s and 50s. They were saying the same stuff, yeah.
And so, well, why would they give a rat's ass about our planet if they didn't live here, too?
They have skin in the game. From what we see, our research, they have skin in the game, and they really should.
We think that one of the things they were trying to get from President Eisenhower, one of the things they were negotiating was us to denuclearize. Mm-hmm. It's very obvious that they're terrified of our nukes. I don't know if terrified is the word or quite unhappy about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
unhappy.
I mean, after we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they start following our planes everywhere they go with these Foo Fighters. And then they prove to us in the 60s that they can turn off our nukes anytime they want to.
Yeah, Malmstrom.
At the Malmstrom incident and the Minot incident. And obviously they're quite concerned about our nukes. And we think that's one of the things they didn't get. And so when people ask me, well, what do they want? That's what they want. They want us to denuclearize. Hmm. And until we do, they are going to follow our military every single time we go out on maneuvers everywhere around the world. They're just making sure that we don't blow up the planet and kill us all, including them.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we finish up, I have a technical writing question for you. How do you write a book together? How did that go? Two people writing a book.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'll jump in here real quick that, you know, we just, after about 20 to 30 years even of looking into this stuff, it was a combination of Leslie got sick. She...
Yeah, I had to have my gallbladder removed for, I spent a year kind of ill. So I had all this free time that I was in a chair and, you know, kind of chair bound. And that was a good opportunity. I'm the writer in the family. I'm a journalist by trade. And Stephen, he had a lot more medical knowledge than I had and more scientific knowledge as far as geology. So we were a good team. Mm-hmm. I did most of the physical writing of the book, the typing, you know, but Stephen had to help me a lot with research. And he wrote all his personal experiences.
Yeah, what happened was that we got to a point where it just didn't seem like it was the book wasn't going to really kind of fly unless we put a bit of a personal touch into it. And I realized at a certain point that all these things that I've been telling Leslie about for, you know, 20, 30 years that have happened that were kind of was part of the impetus for writing the book in the first place.
Right.
That I was trying to figure out for myself just who this old Gleggly character was. And just what the meaning of everything was, and the five different UFOs that I had seen, and then the two that Leslie and I had seen together. And we just basically had to put it down on paper before, you know, before we forgot.
But a pivotal moment for me was, you know, Stephen was telling me about all these experiences, and he had seen three UFOs before. He saw two in 2004, and so 2005 rolls around, and I have still not seen anything, and I'm kind of jealous, you know, and but I believe him. I believe what he tells me, but
95%.
I can only, you know, if you never see it yourself, you can only believe most of the way. You know, I believed him like 95%, I guess. But then in 2005, in January, there was my first UFO. It was one of these bright white lights in the sky that just hovers there, inexplicably hovering. Mm-hmm. And then the thing shot away over the northern horizon and gone in a quarter of a second. It had to be going 20,000 miles an hour. And it shot at 20,000 miles an hour instantly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Not slowly, but mm-hmm. not ramping up to that speed, but just boom, 20,000 miles an hour, quarter of it's visually, it was so fast that it streaked into a line and then the line collapsed behind it.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
There was no missing time as far as what.
Yeah, though we didn't miss any time that time. But
the last one was in October, late October of 2020.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is the pivotal moment of seeing the first one.
Right.
Then, you know, that 95% instantly became 100%.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's when I said to myself, we've got to write this stuff. We've got to write it down.
Right. You know?
And then they found the Hiawatha asteroid impact crater, which I believed was the cause of the flood. And I thought, this is what I've been waiting for, is evidence that this our theories about the Great Flood and the impact crater are correct, right? Turned out to be the wrong crater, but that was one of the impetuses for us to actually right. sit down and put pen to paper, you know?
I needed to get closure for myself. So many unexplained things that had happened to myself and my family for multiple generations. And just curiosity. And just, you know, trying to think things through in a logical, scientific manner, not jumping down rabbit holes, and just trying to say, okay, this is what we're seeing, and what is the most likely explanation? Plus, you know, we're dealing with paranormal stuff and alien stuff, so that also was kind of an interesting factor to have to, like, pull those together and say, okay, what is likely, what is really happening? So that's why we did it.
Any plans for a follow-up book?
Yes, it's about a third of the way written, but just don't know how.
Financially, the first one kind of was.
We spent a lot of money marketing the first one, more than we made. So we have to do a little bit better financially to afford to continue writing books.
You spent $31,000 and make $8,000. It's not a good thing.
Well. The book is Who They Are and What They're Up To. It's by Leslie and Stephen Shaw. Where can people find the book?
It's on Amazon and Ingram. We also have, like I say, our Instagram page is at leslie.shaw.author. And this is where people can read more of Stephen's family's bizarre experiences and, you know, in our series, our various series. And we also have a website at whotheyarebook.com, where we have excerpts, blogs, and links to any podcasts that we have done.
And we have some nicely done reels, too.
And those are on Instagram. Yes, we have some nice reels on Instagram.
I'll make sure
again, it's at leslie.shaw.author.
Mm-hmm. I'll make sure to put all those links in the show notes for this episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Timothy. It was so great. One of our best conversations ever.
All right, well, once again, you've brought another really cool curiosity.
This, I would say, is decidedly different than anything we've had to offer previously.
Mm-hmm. It's a Viking.
It is. I got this, I think, sort of unexpectedly, along with some other stuff in a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Christy said to me, oh, they're actually worth money. Do you know what those are? And then she told me that they're these, like, mid-century teak Vikings that people collected. To me, they remind me of some kind of, like, I don't know, like Rankin and Bass kind of, like,
a little bit. There's
comic.
There's a fellow who, I don't know if you've seen him on Instagram, he makes little acorn people and he'll do these neat little poses and he'll like have them and then like the birds will come and like eat food out of their hands and stuff out of the acorn people and he'll take these beautiful photographs of them. Kind of reminds me a little bit of those as well.
Yeah, these are like, I think, late 60s, early 70s, and they're, you know, sort of Danish modern teak mixed with Viking fur. Yeah, this little guy has little red fur and he's got a sword. He's got his Viking helmet on.
Could be Octavian.
Yeah, it looks a lot like Octavian, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The red beard. Kind of like a mid-century Gimli kind of thing going on.
Yeah, he's got a little Gimli-esque kind of thing.
Do you remember in Baltimore that there was that inexplicably, and I don't think it was ever resolved, of why it was spray-painted Viking women don't care on the side of that one overpass?
Well, yeah, and our friend, this is back when people were doing cassette albums.
Yeah, they did.
They named their cassette that?
Yeah, but I was like, I never understood if that was based on something. I looked it up tonight and I saw there was a book about Baltimore wrestling that, but it was from 2014, but this predated it by like...
Oh yeah, this was the 90s.
Yeah, like early 90s. It was spray paint. Was it like, it was...
It was exit ramp off of 695 going towards Towson, I think.
Yeah, I always remember like coming back from IKEA, you would see it.
Yeah, I think that it was there. Yeah.
I don't think it's still there. I think they redid that whole section.
I think they did, but yeah, I don't know if so. Maybe it has something to do with wrestling in Baltimore. I don't know.
Yeah, or maybe it just has to do with Vikings, or maybe someone met a Viking girl and she really didn't care, and they just
maybe a Viking woman broke somebody's heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Shout out Helga.
Shout out 90s graffiti, obscure graffiti from around
there. Right now, there's someone in Baltimore going, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I guarantee we will get at least one email of somebody saying, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least.
Don't worry. We've been other places and seen weird things.
So this teak Viking, I will take a photo of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put that photo in the show notes. If you click on that, it'll take you to our Etsy shop, mm-hmm. where you can purchase that and other curiosities of the week, those that are left. I like this one a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing good lately.
Mm-hmm.
You've been bringing the goods for the curiosity of the week.
What was that cartoon in the paper that was like a Viking guy?
Hagar the Horrible?
Yeah. The funnies, in the funny pages.
The funnies, yeah. So
a lot of timely references tonight.
Also in our Etsy shop is artwork. I restocked the prints of the Black Dog, of the Bigfoot, Big Heart, and the Mothman. There's other prints in there. John Stink. You can get remark prints of the cover of Where the Footprints End, Volume 2. There's the Wild Man, Hans Trapp, and I forget what else. So lots of prints to choose from. There's also original art. And if I do original art for this episode, which may or may not happen because we're recording at the last minute, it's already late. But if I do original art for this episode, it'll be in there. You can purchase that. There's episode artwork from other episodes in there still you can purchase. Copies of my books, if you get them from there, they come signed. Just added to the Etsy shop is Petals and Thorns zine, volume 2. That little zine of Catholic ephemera I do, full color. It's pretty cool. It's got little old antique pictures of religious and holy and prayer cards. There's an article about the Marian apparitions in Tilly, France from the 1800s.
It's basically like an old goth zine, but you take out all the blasphemous stuff.
And there's a really cool collection of hooded penitents, which are really eerie looking, like they're from Spain and
Italy. Oh, yeah, they're the ones that, and let me preface this by saying, they are in absolutely no way affiliated with the American KKK.
No, they predate it by hundreds of years, and the fact that the KKK chose this look and they're so anti-Catholic is bizarre.
Yeah, it's very, very odd.
But they have pointed hoods.
Sort of dunce cappy kind of look.
Yeah, that was the idea, and which is that something that criminals wore. This was a shameful thing. They're penitents, mm-hmm. you know. It was a humble thing, you know, mm-hmm. that they
like
were
dressed. Like a humility test.
Yeah, but they look really eerie, and they're not...
And
white,
these are all tinted, bizarre colors they never would have been, right?
Yeah. This is really, really interesting stuff. And the one from Italy doesn't have the pointed hood. He's got a hat, and he almost looks like an executioner's hood, but he's wearing looks like a rosary or something with a skull on it, on his belt. Really cool stuff. Really
that is
neat,
cool.
Neat photos. So that's Petals and Thorns, number 2. You can get number 1. You can get number 1 and 2 together as well. There's all kinds of options there. That's in the Flower Pass section of the Etsy shop.
I added some Victorian calling cards, and
a
lot of them, like as in an individual lot, but I also have a lot of them to make into mm-hmm. other lots, so I'll probably be adding this. So there's particular themes that you like flowers or letters or...
These are really beautiful, like that Victorian printing. That's why I like print those old prayer cards and stuff in that zine, because the printing back then was just gorgeous.
It's just something that you'd give away to a friend. So many of these, and I didn't realize it till after I listed them, is that the embossed part of the card is then attached only on one side. And if you lift that up and separate it from the paper below it, it has a calling card. It really literally has someone's name in it.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. They're so neat.
Yeah, they're really just like, and even like the cardstock that they're printed on or that they're attached to is like decoratively cut at mm-hmm. a time when, would they have even had like the equivalent of like... you know, like scrapbooking scissors kind of thing.
They might have been die cut.
Yeah, I bet they were die cut, and then you chose. And then, like, some of them are outlined in rainbow. Like, it's, there's so much work in going that goes into, like, just such a small thing.
Printing back then was such a novel. I mean, it had been around since, you know, the Renaissance. It wasn't that novel, but they were still working, and they were still innovating and printing, and they were doing just beautiful stuff.
You know, any of the German stuff, like the Kremlin stuff, is just...
Yeah.
You can't beat it, and it keeps its color in a way that things that were done 60 years after it has not.
So those are in the Etsy shop.
I'm going to add more, so.
Allison has photos there, Strange Familiar t-shirts, stickers, patches, mugs. That's all there. Our Etsy shop name is Lost Grave. But if you type in Strange Familiars, you should see some of our stuff come up. You can click on that. That'll take you to our shop as well. If you support us on Etsy, you're helping the show out. So thanks, everybody who's done that. All right, I guess that's it for this episode of Strange Familiars. We'll be back soon with more. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Color Arts. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. You can join the Strange Familiars gathering group there. We're on Instagram @strangefamiliars, one word, no underscore. Please follow us, like all our posts, do all the Instagram things there. And what else? We're on YouTube, Strange Familiars as well. For Strange Familiars merch, it's strangefamiliars.com/merch. And strangefamiliars.com is where you can find all of our contact information, and it's open 24/7.
New York Times bestselling author C.J. Box comes the thrilling new novel, Battle Mountain. After a brutal campaign of destruction leaves Game Warden Joe Pickett and Falconer Nate Romanowski in tatters, Nate goes off the grid, preparing for vengeance. Meanwhile, Joe teams up with a rookie to find a missing person in the Sierra Madres, leading both journeys to converge at Battle Mountain. Pick up a copy today, available now wherever books are sold.
When you need
mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.